The English had achieved a famous victory, one that would rank with those of Henry's ancestors at Crécy and Poitiers. They had won it because of their own courage, determination, and professionalism. There is no doubt that the skill of the archers had opened up the way to success, and that their willingness to engage with the enemy at close quarters, with whatever weapon came to hand, had helped to complete it. But the men-at-arms had also made a vital contribution in standing firm against overwhelming odds. There is no doubt also that the inspirational leadership of their king played its part. He had never faltered in his belief that God would overcome his enemies, and he had led by example. On the day, he had proved himself to be superior to his French opponents, not only as a commander of men, but also as a military tactician. Nevertheless, the sheer scale of the French defeat was genuinely humbling, even frightening. Thousands of Frenchmen lay dead on the field of Agincourt. The exact number is impossible to gauge, because contemporary chronicles vary wildly, and there are no comprehensive official records to draw upon. Thomas Walsingham, for instance, gives a very precise figure of 3,069 knights and esquires, plus almost 100 barons, but admits that the number of common people was not counted by the heralds. What is beyond dispute is not so much the precise magnitude of the French losses, but the fact that the corresponding figures for the English dead were, by any standard, infinitesimally small. Only two magnates lost their lives, Edward Duke of York and Michael de la Pole, the young Earl of Suffolk. Most chroniclers suggest that somewhere in the region of 30 others were killed, together with some 4 or 5 gentlemen, of whom only 2 are usually named, Sir Richard Keithley and Davy Gam. These figures are a serious underestimate of the true total. Though the picture is inevitably flawed because the available records are incomplete, one can identify at least 112 men from the English side who were killed in the battle, a figure that excludes those who later died of their wounds. Of these, almost exactly 2/3 were archers, whose names have survived only in Exchequer records and would not have been recorded by any contemporary chronicler. When we turn to the French side, there are no equivalent administrative records to give us even a hint of the numbers of non-noble men who died. What we do have are lists of men whose names have been recorded only because they were entitled to bear a coat of arms. These lists were usually compiled by heralds, but even they were unable to be comprehensive. The main reason the lists of French dead are incomplete is that they were simply so numerous. The list reads like a gazetteer of the towns and villages in the vicinity of Agincourt. What this brings home is the devastating effect that the battle had on life in the region. These men, and those like them from the wider area, were the petty nobility upon whom depended the administration of the military, financial, judicial, and other public affairs of not just the locality, but the whole kingdom. Many of them came not only from the same class, but from the same families. From the greatest to the least, almost every family in the north of France, with any pretension to nobility of birth, lost at least one relative, and in some particularly tragic cases, whole families were wiped out. Even the King of France himself was not exempt. Charles VI lost 7 of his closest blood relatives in the battle. The problem of identifying the dead was made more difficult than it might have been by the fact that the bodies were systematically plundered. The English, as was their right as victors, had stripped the corpses of any valuables, including armour, jewellery, and clothing. These were the legitimate prizes of war, some of which would be kept, particularly the weapons and armour, which would replace those lost or damaged by the men-at-arms, but most of which would be sold for profit. There was so much to be taken that Henry, ever conscious of the possibility of a French rally or an ambush on the road, became concerned that his men were overburdening themselves, and gave orders that no one was to acquire more than he needed for himself. Once the English had finished, the corpses were despoiled for a second time by the local people, who literally stripped them stark naked. Without their banners, pennons, surcoats, or coats of arms, it was impossible for the heralds to identify which individuals had been killed. There were too many bodies lying on the battlefield for the English to contemplate giving them all a Christian burial. We do not even know whether they did this for their own compatriots. Certainly the corpses of some of the more eminent victims, in particular Edward, Duke of York, and Michael, Earl of Suffolk, were recovered for removal to England. In the end, it fell to the local clergy to make the necessary arrangements for the internment of the unidentified dead. A series of long trenches were dug, and somewhere in the region of 6,000 corpses received a crude but Christian burial in these anonymous grave pits. A great wooden cross was raised over each mass grave, but no permanent memorial was erected until the 19th century, and their location is still a matter of dispute today. The dead of Agincourt were not the first, nor yet the last, to find an anonymous corner in the graveyard of Europe, which is the Somme. The homecoming was an altogether quieter and humbler affair than the original invasion. The great fleet that had brought the English to France had disbanded many weeks earlier, and though the king had undertaken to pay for the return crossing, he no longer had the means to take his army back with him en masse. Instead, the veterans of the campaign had to find their own passage across the Channel. Each man was allowed 2 shillings for his own fare, together with a further 2 shillings for each horse, and it was left to the captains of the retinues to make the necessary arrangements privately with shipowners and masters visiting the port. The greatest part of the victorious army thus made its way back to England from Calais without flourish or fanfare. The men slipped quietly into the Cinque Ports in dribs and drabs, before dispersing to their homes in towns, villages, and farmsteads the length and breadth of the country. The hero's welcome was reserved for their monarch. News of Henry's return spread swiftly, and when he set out for London, he found his road already lined with cheering crowds. The spontaneous celebrations that greeted the news of Agincourt were as nothing compared to those which hailed the return of the victorious king. The citizens of London, accustomed to festivities on a grand scale, had almost a month to prepare for this event, and the result was as elaborate and visually stunning a pageant as medieval ingenuity could devise. Important steps were also taken to ensure that Henry's victory could not be forgotten or passed over. At the king's personal request, the Archbishop of Canterbury decreed that henceforth, the 23rd of April, the Feast of St. George, the special patron and protector of the English nation, by whose intervention we unhesitatingly believe the army of the English nation is directed against enemy attacks in time of wars, was to become a double festival in the church calendar. This meant it would remain a public holiday, but additionally, it would now become a day when people ought to go to church, as they did at Christmas. Less well known than this enhancement of the status of England's patron saint was a similar order enforcing the holding of public holidays on the festivals of 3 Welsh saints, Winifred, David, and Chad. This was a gracious and politically astute acknowledgement of the role played by the Welsh archers and their patron saints in achieving the victory at Agincourt. In England, the delight that greeted the victory at Agincourt found expression in a host of political songs and popular ballads. The minstrels in the retinues of the great lords, many of whom had accompanied the English army to France, were expected to celebrate the deeds of their patrons, and Agincourt was the ideal topic for courtly and chivalric gatherings. It was also a gift for the wandering minstrels, who earned their living by going from one knightly household to another to perform. Though no examples have survived, the impact of the minstrel songs on the popular imagination cannot be ignored. They ensured that news of the king's victory reached the more remote rural communities, encouraged a feeling of national pride and unity, and were a powerful recruiting agent for Henry's next campaign. Indeed, it might be argued that they preserved the place of Agincourt in the national consciousness for centuries to come. When the last vestiges of English power in France were slowly but inexorably eradicated, people looked back to the glory days of Agincourt with nostalgia. Ballads, chronicles, and plays preserved the memory of the victory and served as a rallying cry for future wars in France. Just as the English chaplain wrote his Gesta Henrici Quinti in the build-up to Henry V's second invasion of Normandy, so the first English life of King Henry V was written in anticipation of the launch of Henry VIII's war against France. As late as the 1940s, Winston Churchill, who was then Prime Minister, asked Laurence Olivier to make a film of Shakespeare's Henry V to prepare the nation psychologically for the D-Day landings in Normandy, which were to liberate Europe from Nazi occupation. Agincourt played a vital role in establishing that Henry had a moral right to the throne of France. God had approved his demand for the restoration of his just rights and inheritances in spectacular fashion. He had won the trial by battle. Perhaps more importantly, Henry had proved beyond all doubt that he was also the true king of England. God had chosen to bless him with victory at Agincourt, despite the fact that he was the son of a usurper. There could have been no more effective demonstration to the world that the sins of the father would not be held against this son. Henry V clearly enjoyed divine approval. And with God on his side, who could stand against him?